From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. During his confirmation hearing, President Biden's nominee for Attorney General Merrick Garland told U.S. senators that if confirmed, he would make the investigation of the January 6th insurrection his first priority. And he also sketched out what kind of Justice Department he would lead.
We do not yet have equal justice. Communities of color and other minorities still face discrimination in housing, in education, in employment, and in the criminal justice system. And they bear the brunt of the harm caused by pandemic, pollution, and climate change.
Joining us now is NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Happy to do it.
So how is the confirmation process going so far? What are your impressions of Merrick Garland?
It seems to be going very smoothly, and that's really no surprise. Merrick Garland has had experience at nearly every level of the justice system in his career, which is now 44 years long. He's moderate and pretty well respected across the political aisle. Democrats have been calling on him to restore confidence in the Justice Department after the tumultuous years under Donald Trump and to take the lead in the Capitol riots investigation. And Republicans are asking him a lot about old scandals from the Obama years.
This morning, ranking Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said no one doubts Garland is qualified, but he has some questions about how Garland would run the Justice Department.
I don't want consent decrees that federalize law enforcement and cause murder rates to soar. I don't want a return to catch and release on the border.
Carrie Johnson, if confirmed, how would a Merrick Garland Justice Department be different from the Trump Justice Department on police reform or immigration enforcement?
Well, Merrick Garland said President Joe Biden does not want to defund the police, as some activists do, and neither does Merrick Garland. He says he would support, as the president does, some offloading of police responsibilities when it comes to people who are mentally ill or suicidal, something law enforcement says it wants. He also said he would follow Biden's lead on a potential moratorium on the federal death penalty, but he didn't go so far as to say that he would support the president commuting or shortening the sentences of people already on death row. And finally, he pledged cooperation with an investigation into the family separation practice in the Trump years. But he did not pledge that he would, at the Justice Department, investigate that himself.
What about stopping the Russia investigation by Special Counsel John Durham? Senator Grassley asked about that. He also asked whether Judge Garland and President Biden have discussed any investigations of Biden's son, Hunter. What did Merrick Garland say about that?
Garland said, so far as he knows, which is not that much, there's no reason to end the Durham investigation now. He plans to meet with John Durham after he's confirmed as Attorney General and find out where Durham is going and what resources he might need. With respect to the Hunter Biden tax investigation, Garland says he's going to do everything in his power, which will be considerable, to avoid any partisan politics infecting law enforcement decisions at Justice. He says he has not discussed the Hunter Biden matter with Joe Biden or anybody else, and he does not intend to. He is drawing a bright line there between the Justice Department and the White House.
Would you say confirmation is a sure thing, Carrie?
I wouldn't say anything is a sure thing in this day and age, but I've got to say I've heard a lot of support from Republican senators today, including Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, John Cornyn of Texas, and many others. Merrick Garland is a consensus nominee and a moderate. And in fact, we're going to get a full committee vote March 1st, next week, in 1 week's time, about advancing his nomination further.
About 40 seconds, Carrie. While we have you, what did you make of the Supreme Court's decision this morning on the release of former President Trump's tax returns?
Oh, the timing was fascinating given the ongoing Garland hearing. Obviously, this is a decision that will be cheered by the Manhattan District Attorney, which is investigating this matter. And the President Biden seems to want to leave this to local authorities. We'll see what Attorney General Merrick Garland has to say about it if he's confirmed.
Carrie Johnson is NPR Justice Correspondent covering the confirmation hearing today of President Biden's nominee for Attorney General Merrick Garland. Carrie Johnson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
In Texas, the weather is improving today, but one in three people in the state are still having problems with water after last week's wretched winter storm. Broken pipes, orders to boil water, and in some areas, still no power. Mario Canizares is the city manager of Nacogdoches, a small city in a forested part of eastern Texas.
Once we got through the rolling blackouts, the ice storm that we had between Tuesday night into Wednesday morning really affected us immensely, because then it became more infrastructure issues. Trees and power lines just do not go well together. And so it's just been a very difficult situation to repair.
Earlier today, Canizares told me that 5,000 people in the area still don't have power, and it could be a while.
It could be several more days in some areas, in some more heavily wooded areas where trees have fallen and has knocked down electrical systems that it just can't get to them, or it just requires more work. So they're tackling those areas that they can restore quickly, then rediverting their efforts to some of those more difficult areas.
Katie Mungia is a social worker who lives in Nacogdoches. She lost power last Monday. It didn't come back on until Saturday, and she knows how dangerous those falling trees can be. She told me that one landed on her parents' house.
Yeah, so a branch fell. They have this massive, you know, probably like 200-year-old live oak tree in their backyard, and a branch fell on the roof. We tried to pull it down with ropes, and it was frozen into the ice. There were about 5 inches of solid ice on the roof, so we couldn't get it out. So finally, this weekend, as it started to thaw, we were able to get the branch off and found that it had, in fact, penetrated the roof. So, you know, a lot of, and that's pretty minor compared to what other people have. I've known friends who have had both of their vehicles smushed by trees that fell on them, or someone had a tree branch break into their kitchen, fell into their kitchen that they had just had remodeled, you know. So there's been some pretty intense damage to people's homes.
During the storm, I mean, could you tell that there was all that damage with the trees happening, or did you just wake up to it in the morning and you saw all these trees down?
No, I mean, so it was a really surreal and terrifying experience. I remember, I guess Wednesday was sort of when we had the second wave of the storm, when all the trees were coated in ice. And I remember stepping outside and, you know, there's no electricity at this point, so everything is just silent. But you would just hear this crashing of branches falling. And I'm talking, you know, I mean, just every 5 seconds, probably you hear another crack and then the boom as it hits the ground, and a crack and a boom of these massive branches falling all around our neighborhoods, and which is terrifying, right? Because you don't know when the next one is going to fall on you or on your house. And, you know, we were trying to enjoy the snow a little bit with my daughter, but trying to stay away from trees. We didn't want to be under any trees because they were just dropping branches so rapidly. I mean, it felt like being in a war zone. I mean, you know, just with this crashing and the sound of the ice falling, the branches falling, entire trees falling. And then not much that you could do about it because it was still snowing, still sleeting. There was all the ice out there. You know, and so like that branch on my parents' roof, they had to wait several days before we could do anything about it. So you really didn't get a sense of the extent of the damage, even though we knew it was happening. You didn't get a sense of the damage until Saturday, really, when things started to thaw out.
Well, and you are a social worker. I know many of your clients likely live in trailers or in more vulnerable structures around town. How are your clients doing, the people you work with?
You know, today I'm just able to get back to work, and so that's sort of what I'm doing today. I'm going to be going out and visiting some of those neighborhoods and seeing how people are faring. You know, in trailers, there's not a lot of insulation of pipes, so I'm sure there's been a lot of busted pipes. A lot of those homes already were in pretty poor conditions. A lot of folks that I work with have holes in their floor, holes in their roofs, missing windows, missing doors. So they were extremely vulnerable to the cold. I think a lot of those people ended up having to relocate, go stay somewhere else. Because, you know, we got down to 1 degree here, which is something that, at least in my lifetime, has just been absolutely unheard of. We're not prepared for that kind of cold here.
So, Katie, considering what you just told me, how long do you think the recovery will take? And I mean both physically, getting all those trees removed and that sort of thing, but also emotionally as well. It has not been an easy year, and this week has been particularly difficult.
Right, absolutely. I mean, anytime you feel unsafe, right? That's a trauma, right? When you are in a situation where you feel like you can't do anything to protect yourself or the people that you love, that's traumatic. And that's what all of us here have been living through. And, you know, definitely myself included, it was really terrifying. And, you know, today I'm supposed to be getting back to work and sitting down at my computer, figuring out, you know, how am I going to reach out to families? What am I going to do? But it's just really hard to focus, you know, to get my mind on work, to do what I need to do, kind of get back to normal, because nothing feels normal. Nothing about this past week has felt normal. But, you know, we just have to get up and keep moving, keep walking forward, because there's kind of no other choice.
Katie Munguia, social worker living in Nacogdoches, Texas. Sounds tough out there. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
In Los Angeles, homelessness was a major problem even before the pandemic hit. Now, the two crises are converging. Health officials are trying to vaccinate 65,000 people who are experiencing homelessness in LA County. But at the same time, a vaccine shortage recently shuttered many local vaccination sites. Shannon Fernando is a nurse practitioner at the Los Angeles Christian Health Centers. She's been working with the homeless population. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you.
I know this can be a tough population of people to keep track of. So how are you going about vaccinating those who don't have stable housing in the Los Angeles area?
That's a great question. I think we've really employed a three-pronged approach. So the first approach has really been leveraging existing community partnerships and basically utilizing those existing relationships to then encourage people to get vaccinated in those settings. And the second approach really has been to utilize our street medicine model. So basically, our street medicine teams go out into the community and encourage them, letting them know, hey, we have a vaccine clinic happening around the corner. You know, we can't walk around with the vaccine once it's punctured. You have to remain stable in a stationary location. So folks will just come to us through our street medicine team outreaching to them. And then really the final approach is our clinic. We're a federally qualified health center. And so we've been really packaging the vaccine, so to speak, so ensuring that they feel that the vaccine is safe because it's part of a regular healthcare visit with their provider. That's one of the ways we've been able to just foster trust with the vaccine process as well.
You make a good point about trust. When you go out and you're having conversations with people and you're trying to convince them that it's a good idea to get a shot, how are they responding? I mean, what is the level of trust with these people who you're trying to vaccinate?
So it could really vary, you know, and I think there's some very justifiable fear and mistrust with the vaccine process and sort of just in a community where there's already some mistrust with healthcare professionals. And so I think what we've really been trying to do is even just share anecdotes about how we've gotten the vaccine. So talking about how I felt after I got the vaccine, as well as sharing, of course, the evidence and the data behind it that's helpful for folks to understand that the vaccine is safe to take.
Do people tell you why they're worried about taking it?
Yeah, of course. I think one main reason is the side effects. Folks are concerned about side effects. And then because the vaccine was developed so quickly, just wondering about the long-term safety of the vaccine.
Yeah. I know that hospitals across the country and really across your state of California, they're all facing shortages of COVID vaccines. So how many doses are your clinics getting, and do you have enough to reach this population of people, which we mentioned, tens of thousands of people in LA County?
So right now we are given a weekly allocation of 100 doses. So every week we get 100.
100?
Yes, 100 doses. Yeah, it's definitely not enough to meet the demand and to meet all of our patients who are experiencing homelessness. The other challenge, in addition to the amount of doses, is the fact that our people experiencing homelessness tend to age more quickly, meaning that the 65 and over sort of criteria is hard to really attach to people experiencing homelessness, especially when people experiencing homelessness tend to die 20 years younger than the non-people experiencing homelessness. And so that's been really kind of a strategy we're trying to navigate to figure out how to get our vulnerable patients vaccinated.
When you say that you get about 100 doses a week for this population, it makes me wonder if you think that for whatever reason, these people aren't being prioritized. I mean, in other words, would the government just rather get other people vaccinated and just kind of throw you a handful of them and say, go do what you can with it? I just want to make sure that people are paying enough attention to these folks.
Right. And I think what's hard about where we're at in our county, for LA County right now in particular, is the strategy of having this one size fit all, so to speak, criteria of vaccinating only 65 and older, being able to vaccinate people experiencing homelessness 50 and older would be a more efficacious and a more strategic way to really get shots into arms more quickly and to really impact a vulnerable population. At this point, correct. Yeah, we are still following, of course, the guidelines that we've been given.
I see. Well, I mentioned that this is a community that can be hard to keep track of. And we also know that with the doses that we have on the market right now, they both require two shots. So how do you keep track of folks after the first vaccine is given?
So really what we've been doing is making sure they know exactly when to come back. So we pre-schedule their appointment for their second dose. So they know the day, the time, the location. And then, you know, we make sure we get any contact information. And if they don't have contact information, if they're willing for us to take a quick photo of them so we know how to look for them again. So those are some of the strategies, really organic grassroots ways we're trying to ensure that we can find folks again in 4 weeks.
So what's your message to people who are listening about why what you're doing is important?
We really need to be looking at this population in a different light and really starting to understand the nuances and the ways that certain health conditions are more prevalent in this population. We need something that's also agile to get shots into arms for people who can't access those megapods, who can't drive, who may not have access to the internet or things like that. And so we really want to be able to continue to be the safety net for our community members. And that means getting more vaccines into our hands so that we can give it to our community members.
Right, because if you're a person without stable housing, you likely don't have a car, which means you're not getting to Dodger Stadium to get a vaccine at that mass megapod, as you call it. Shannon Fernando, a nurse practitioner, they also call you a chief innovations officer there at the LA Christian Health Centers, and I can see why you have to get creative to do this job. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The New River Gorge in southern West Virginia is America's 63rd and newest national park. The designation was one of the initiatives tucked into the $2.3 trillion coronavirus relief and spending bill passed in December, and we want to learn more about it. Lizzie Watts is the new park's superintendent. Lizzie, welcome. Nice to speak with you, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. We're pleased to be with y'all today and excited about being here to share news about the new national park and preserve.
And we're excited to hear it. So first, if I could ask you to paint a picture for us, what makes the New River Gorge so remarkable?
Well, there are many things, but the four areas that are now in the national park are four of the more spectacular. One is Sandstone Falls. Next is, as you move north, is you'll go to Grandview. And Grandview is the highest part. It's 1,400 feet, an incredible view of the whole river. And it has a tremendous forest with rhododendrons and bird habitat and special species. And then if you go even further north, the next place tells about our remarkable human history here for coal mining, railroading, and logging. And that's the little town of Thurmond, where the historic depot is open. The last but not the least, the most important area is actually the gorge. And that really highlights the river. It's narrow and windy and steep, and people come to climb the rock, and they come to whitewater boat and to fish. But it is spectacular. 7 miles of whitewater. Those four parts are the special parts of the park, and then the other 90% will be preserved.
I want to know more about the history of this area. Of course, this is West Virginia. You mentioned that coal mining and logging were once pretty prominent along the river. Tell me more about, you know, what has happened since then and how the area has been preserved and restored.
It's really quite remarkable. We get a lot of sunshine and a lot of rain in the Southern Appalachians. And that combination has allowed the natural forest to come back. So you don't see the same picture you would have seen 100 years ago when you look out of the Canyon Rim Visitor Center's window. You actually see complete forest.
You know, it's interesting that there will be a few things allowed in this national park that just generally aren't allowed in many others across the country. And that includes hunting in certain areas. And also, is this right, base jumping off the 876-foot-high New River Gorge Bridge at least once a year?
Yes, sir. The bridge actually is owned by the state, and it's one of their historic sites. And they do base jump from the top of the bridge, but they land in the park. They land hopefully in the little area called Fayette Station Beach. It happens once a year in October, and people literally come from all over the world. It's considered one of the safer base jumps because we have all kinds of safety people involved in it. But these parachutists are the best in the world.
This park sounds like a good place to get your adrenaline pumping.
It is high adventure in a lot of ways. But it's also, it also has those beautiful places that you can just sit and be inspired by the river. We forget how many people in the world need that respite or a place just to go and enjoy nature. And this is one of the places you can do it with high adventure or no adventure and just come and relax.
Well, the New River was designated a national river in 1978. So really, the area has been part of the national park system for a while now. But this is a big new step for you and the people in that area. What does it mean, personally, and to the state of West Virginia, now that it's officially a national park?
Well, I think for us, it means that other people in the world now recognize this incredible resource and that we're protecting it at the highest level for future generations.
You know, I remember driving through West Virginia a couple of years ago for the first time and just being absolutely shocked and surprised at how gorgeous the landscape is there. Do you think the state is sort of underappreciated in that regard?
Oh, I really do. I don't think most people actually have a clue of how gorgeous the state of West Virginia is. It has mountains, it's got gorges, it's got cliff lines, it's got forests, lots of waterways. It really is one of those hidden gems in the United States. And maybe with the new designation, it won't be quite as hidden.
Lizzie Watts is the superintendent of the New River Gorge National Park and Preserve. It is the country's newest national park. Thank you very much. We're going to post pictures at hereandnow.org so people can see for themselves. Lizzie, have a great day. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at zooty.com.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do at a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capitol Gazette.
Kings of kings, lords of lords.
In Jamaica, it's called toasting when a DJ talks over a record to the rhythm of a song. It's a phenomenon that started in the 60s and 70s. Ewart Beckford, better known as U-Roy, took that art to new levels and transformed Jamaican music. On that journey, he influenced genres like dancehall, reggae, and even the early days of hip-hop. U-Roy has died at the age of 78. To talk about U-Roy's legacy, let me welcome Patricia Moschino. She's a writer for Billboard who's been covering Caribbean music for almost three decades. Patricia, how nice to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So U-Roy expanded the role of DJ. He didn't just introduce records. He added a layer of vocal and even verbal improv to them. Describe that for us and why it was so revolutionary.
Yeah, before U-Roy, the DJ would be the person at the sound system dance who would introduce the record or just find a way to engage the crowd further so they would stay. And U-Roy took that, but when he got into recording, his rhymes transcended that of what would be done on the sound system into all kinds of directions. Even the introductory song that you played was very much a spiritual incantation of Rastafari. So it was very revolutionary stuff at 1970. But as the year went on, he recorded three really major hits for producer Duke Reid, which would go on to occupy the top three slots on Jamaican radio station charts for 6 weeks. And that just led to an explosion of people wanting to sound like U-Roy, a lot of people who did sound like U-Roy, but it just made for establishing DJing, toasting as a viable music form.
Well,
in
yeah.
Jamaica.
And he sure launched many careers to international audiences, didn't he?
every step that Jamaican music has made internationally, particularly on the DJing side, which can be traced back to U-Roy, you know, Shabba Ranks being one of the biggest names who learned their craft working with the master on his sound. Mm.
We heard Rightful Ruler at the top. Let's take another listen to one of his great songs, 1983's Zsa Zsa Call You.
So long, Mr. Just stop you coming and come for Zsa Zsa Call You. And Zsa Zsa Call You.
U-Roy had a huge impact on dance hall, on reggae, and even rap and hip-hop, didn't he, Patricia?
He's not given the credit he has deserved throughout his life for all that he contributed, the foundations he established. But one person who has credited him numerous times is DJ Kool Herc, the founding father of hip-hop, who, you know, brought his sound system experience that he observed as a kid growing up in Kingston, Jamaica, brought it to the Bronx, tried to emulate what he saw U-Roy do on the mic with his mic man, and the rest, as they say, is history. So U-Roy is that person that it traces back to. That's why he's referred to as the godfather of hip-hop and the godfather of dancehall.
The godfather is right. That's Patricia Moschino, writer for Billboard, on the legacy of the late, great Jamaican musician legend U-Roy. Patricia, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today, more than 5 million people in Texas who have water will no longer need to boil it. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality now says tap water in Houston and other cities is safe to drink. But many other Texans across the state still don't even have water to boil because of all the plumbing problems brought on by last week's destructive winter storms. At a press conference yesterday, Governor Greg Abbott said they are working on a solution.
The state is stepping up to do everything that we can to help people in their homes who are trying to repair busted pipes. One thing that we're doing is we are bringing in more plumbers. Plumbers will be in high demand. We want to make sure that we have a supply that can meet that demand. We urge everybody who may have broken pipes to call a plumber as quickly as possible.
For many people in Houston without running water, water distribution is their lifeline. More than 18,000 units of water were given out at a drive-through distribution event at Butler Stadium yesterday. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner was there and tried to reassure residents without water that they are not forgotten.
I just want people to know that even though the power has been restored and the water pressure has been normalized, that we are not stepping away from them until their situations are addressed wherever they may be in our city.
There's also a statewide effort to distribute water. Yesterday, Governor Abbott said the Texas Air Guard, the Texas National Guard, and the military are collaborating on this. Governor Abbott said they've delivered about 3.5 million bottles so far.
And water is at the center of a case before the Supreme Court between Florida and Georgia. Attorneys for both states gave oral arguments there today. It's not the first time the states have argued over water, and the outcome of the case will affect communities and economies in both states. We have two reports now on what's at stake, starting with Molly Samuel of WABE in Georgia.
The Flint River starts from springs near the Atlanta airport. It grows as it flows south from there and eventually rushes right along Casey Cox's farm in Camilla in southwest Georgia.
We have a really high, muddy winter river right now that we're standing beside.
Cox's family grows sweet corn, peanuts, and timber here. She's a sixth-generation farmer, now taking over operations from her dad. She says this river is special to her. She grew up on it, and her love for the Flint is part of what brought her back to her family's farm after college.
In the summer, it's really low and clear and beautiful, and there's a big sandbar right there, which I love.
Cox is 29 years old, which means that for pretty much as long as she's been alive, Florida and Georgia have been fighting over the water in this river. The Flint meets another Georgia river, the Chattahoochee, at the Florida border. They combine to form the Apalachicola River, which flows through the Florida Panhandle. Cox says her dad advocated for Georgia farmers around water rights earlier in his career.
He's transitioned that over to me along with the farm, so it's just really unbelievable to think that we're going into the second generation of these water issues.
Florida and Alabama say Georgia uses too much of the water in the rivers that the states share. Now Florida has taken this fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. Florida says in times of drought, Georgia's water use has affected the environment along the Apalachicola River. The state says that's contributed to the crash of the oyster population and the oyster industry in Apalachicola Bay. So Florida is asking the Supreme Court to put a cap on Georgia's water use during droughts. And it's come to focus on the amount of water used by Georgia farmers in the Flint River Basin. Farmers like Casey Cox.
My entire future is in agriculture and farming alongside this river. So I have to have access to water for irrigation to give me certainty for the future, to have a strong livelihood going forward.
Farmers say limiting their water supply would have ripple effects in the region.
I hate to use the word cataclysmic, but it'll be significant.
Murray Campbell grows cotton and peanuts on the other end of Mitchell County from Cox's farm. He says if he was told, for instance, he had to cut his water use in half, he might just decide to put it all in one crop.
So you cut potential for income in half, you're going to have to cut back on something. You may have to let a man go that's been working for you for 20 or 30 years. You might not can afford that much labor. It'll just roar through the economy.
And not just the local farm economy. Doug Mile is an advisor to the Georgia Chamber of Commerce. He says if Florida wins the case, the economic impact would go beyond rural communities because agriculture is the biggest industry in the state.
There is no question it would flow across the entire community and the entire state. Yeah, people would be displaced.
Georgia argues that any potential solution for Florida wouldn't be worth the economic harm to Georgia. It also says Florida itself is partially to blame for allowing over-harvesting of the oysters after the BP oil spill. Georgia says the fix Florida's asking for wouldn't actually solve the oyster industry's problems. Two independent experts hired by the court to make recommendations have sided with Georgia. For her part, Casey Cox says she understands what people in Apalachicola are going through. She says the oystermen there and farmers here in Georgia face shared challenges.
We're all impacted by drought. We all depend on these natural resources for our livelihoods.
Cox says she hopes the states can stop suing each other and instead find a way to work together to find solutions. But once this case is over, there's another one brought by the state of Alabama over the same water. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel in Georgia.
And I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas of WFSU at the Jim Woodruff Dam in Chattahoochee, Florida. It's here, where the Flint and Chattahoochee rivers join to form the Apalachicola, home to a bay that used to be known for its seafood. Most notably, its oysters. When it rains a lot in South Georgia, water flows freely into Florida. But when there's drought, as there was for 10 consecutive months in 2012, water stays behind the dam. And this is a source of conflict between the states.
We're not asking for a great amount of water more. We're just asking for an equal share of water.
This is oysterman Shannon Hartsfield in 2012, during the drought. The Apalachicola Bay oyster fishery had just crashed. It still hasn't recovered. In a more recent interview, Hartsfield said that he hasn't harvested oysters in nearly a decade.
I actually quit harvesting oysters in probably middle of 2012. Started working on trying to rebuild the bay. I worked and ran quite a few programs of using the oystermen rebuilding the bay.
These efforts haven't worked as hoped. Florida recently put a 5-year ban on oyster harvesting in the bay. Researchers and oystermen are still figuring out how to make oysters viable again. One thing they know they need, adequate freshwater input. That's what Florida is after as the U.S. Supreme Court hears its case against Georgia. Florida wants to cap water usage by farms along the Flint. It claims those farms are taking more than their fair share of water.
The Flint River is an area where there's a lot of agriculture.
Georgia Ackerman is executive director at Apalachicola Riverkeeper, whose mission it is to protect the river and bay.
Atlanta is also dependent on Lake Lanier for drinking water in the system. So ultimately, Florida wants a consumptive use cap on Georgia's water usage.
This is the second time the issue has been before the nation's high court. A special master, appointed by the court in 2014, ruled Florida had been harmed as a result of Georgia's water use, but ultimately said the state had no case because part of the blame is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps manages the dam, but wasn't included in the lawsuit. The second special master's report said the state didn't prove that capping Georgia's water use would lead to an increase in flow to the bay. Ackerman, the riverkeeper, also blames the Army Corps.
More and more water has been held upstream for upstream consumption, and that has negatively impacted, it has hurt the Apalachicola floodplain and bay.
To Ackerman, a better way to resolve the issue would be for the dam's managers to adjust water flow according to historical flood cycles. But even if Florida were to win its lawsuit against Georgia, the ruling would have no impact on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Its water control manual says if there's drought in Georgia, that state would get water priority.
And so if we go into drought operations like we did in 2011 and 2012, it's probable that we could see even worse results.
While hoping for a Supreme Court win, Ackerman and others are trying another route. Apalachicola Riverkeeper is part of a coalition suing to change the manual with an eye towards getting more water through the dam and into the bay. If neither case pans out, river flows will continue to be managed as they have been for decades. Still, with the bay closed to oyster harvesting to give reefs time to regenerate and more rainfall in the past 2 years, Shannon Hartsfield is optimistic for the return of the Apalachicola oyster.
My dad is about to turn 73 years old, and I'd love to be able to take him back out with me and harvest oysters again with him. So this is the first time in a long time that I actually see a future back in the bay.
The Supreme Court will likely decide Florida versus Georgia in a couple of months. For Here and Now, I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas.
Airlines around the world are grounding their Boeing 777 planes following the engine explosion on a United flight over Colorado on Saturday. Officials are trying to figure out why the plane's right engine blew apart shortly after takeoff from Denver International Airport. Here's sound from the cockpit.
Mayday, mayday, United 328 Heavy, mayday, mayday, aircraft.
328 Heavy, say again, can you read all that again?
Denver departure, United 328 Heavy, mayday aircraft, just experienced an engine failure, need to turn immediately.
Nobody was injured in that incident. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, who's been following this story. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
Wow, so the pilot who issued that mayday call did seem pretty calm during what had to be a pretty scary situation. He is trained for that, of course. But what have we learned so far about what happened?
A scary situation indeed. Yeah, an airplane can fly for a time and land on one engine, as this one did. Of course, you lose all margin for error. This is a twin-engine aircraft, as most are nowadays. You only start with two engines. And it's not a foregone conclusion that everybody will be okay. Southwest Airlines passenger died back in 2018 when an engine came apart and a fan blade pierced the fuselage and she was partly sucked out. Things like that have happened. And then, of course, you had those parts flying over to Denver, over to Denver area. Fortunate that nobody was struck by those.
That's a miracle. All right, the NTSB and the FAA are now trying to figure out what went wrong with that engine, and I think they're looking at the fan blade, correct? The fan blade, what are they looking for?
They are, yeah. It seems preliminarily like two fan blades. These are hollow fan blades, which are particular to this kind of engine on the 777. They came off and that, you know, created a chain of events that ultimately the engine had what's called an uncontained failure. That's where, you know, the parts actually scatter like these did. And FAA Administrator Steve Dixon indicated that they might end up recommending, assuming these planes are back in the air at some point, more frequent maintenance. So probably one of the first things you're going to look at is, you know, is there some kind of metal fatigue of some part, or was there a problem, a mistake during maintenance? And although, you know, it's really early to guess, if he's saying more frequent maintenance, that's probably indicating that they're concerned about something with the engine and not something about maybe how it was maintained the last time it was in the shop.
And tell us more about the engine. It's a Pratt & Whitney 4000. Have there been issues with it?
So this was one of three engine options back on these old 777s. This is a 26-year-old airplane. Not uncommon to fly in a plane that's that old. You know, airlines, if they maintain planes, well, can keep them in the air for decades. So each engine manufacturer, you know, GE is another, touts their engine as being the most efficient, the most cost-effective, that sort of thing. Airlines generally believe that all of the engines are equally safe. And this is one that has generally had a good record. Nothing that really jumps out at you kind of looking over the years for an engine that's been in service so long that would make you think this one was inherently more dangerous than one of the other options that an airline like United could have chosen back then.
So as a result, though, several airlines have grounded their 777s, and some countries are banning them from entering their airspace. What kind of impact do you think that's going to have on travel around the world?
Right. So you've got basically the U.S., Japan, and South Korea as the big countries where you had airlines with a substantial number of these. United had more than anybody else, but airlines in those countries too. A few smaller countries, Ukraine, you know, with one of them, according to CH Aviation, which has a database of this sort of thing. But yeah, the U.K. banned them from entering its airspace. Now, the practical implication of that is almost nothing because, again, those other countries already told their airlines you can't fly these things. What's interesting about that is that, you know, this is sort of the post-MAX crash era, yeah. Right, where, you know, the FAA lost some credibility around the world, and because it kind of dragged its heels seemingly from the viewpoint of other countries at that time and grounding the plane, waiting several days, countries like Canada and others said, hey, we're not waiting for you. You can't fly those planes here. So in this case, regardless of what the UK had done, there weren't going to be any of these planes in its airspace because the other countries had already taken that measure. Japan did first, but the FAA, within less than a day from Japan's move, did the same thing, and finally South Korea. But kind of interesting that the UK felt the need to basically take it upon itself and say, you know, the plane doesn't come back into this country until we say it can.
Well, and what kind of trouble is this for Boeing? I mean, they just, as you say, started to climb out from under the 737 MAX problem.
Yeah, look, the impact of everything right now in terms of on the flying public is ironically in some ways less than it normally would be because so few people are flying, right? So these airplanes are just working less than they usually do. When you have to ground a plane, it's just, you know, and especially February tends to be a low an off-peak travel period anyway. And so, you know, the impact on these airlines isn't all that great. The impact on the traveling public isn't all that great. But yeah, it's just another sort of mark on Boeing's record, which, although it knows that, you know, in the end, this is also associated with the engine manufacturer. Yeah, something that Boeing also is associated with.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. Seth Kaplan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.